Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into the nuts and bolts, pulling back the curtain on the unseen processes, the security stuff that powers our digital world every day. We're working from a pretty comprehensive technical foundations study guide, trying to distill some key insights. Think of it as understanding the plumbing. Yeah. So let's just jump right in. What really happens when you type, say, www.amazon.com into your browser? I think it's simple, right? Instant. But underneath, there's this whole hidden world of operation security checks happening.
Oh, absolutely. It seems trivial, but that single action kicks off this incredibly complex chain reaction across layers of technology, often in just milliseconds. And understanding these foundations is not just academic. It's really key to grasping how modern tech works and, crucially, how we try to keep it safe.
Okay, let's unpack that journey. We type www.amazon.com. What's the absolute first step? What does the browser need first?
Right, first hurdle. DNS resolution. Basically, translating that name you typed, www.amazon.com, into an IP address the computers understand. It checks its own cache first, as it looked this up recently, then the operating system's cache. If no LUT there, then it starts asking around. It queries a DNS recursor, which might talk to a root name server, the TLD server for .com, and finally, the authoritative name server for amazon.com. That last one has the actual IP.
It sounds like a phone book lookup, but you mentioned before DNS is actually kind of old and maybe fragile. Does the browser always use the system's DNS settings? Can it go rogue?
That's a really sharp point about DNS vulnerability. And no, not always. Most browsers use the system settings, sure. But some, Chrome is a big example, can actually bypass all that. They use something called DNS over HTTPS, or DOH. It encrypts the query itself and sends it directly to a DOH provider. Better privacy from your local network, maybe, but it does centralize things.
Interesting. Okay, so DNS lookup, done. We have the IP address. What's next? How do we actually talk to the server?
Okay, IP address in hand. Now, the browser initiates a TCP connection. Think of it like dialing the phone number. And it needs a specific port number on the server side, usually port 80 for standard HTTP or port 443 for secure HTTPS. The browser just knows which one based on whether the URL starts HTTP or HTTPS.
Right, HTTPS, that's where the lock icon comes from. We hear encryption, but what's really going on there, it's not just one thing, is it?
Okay.
No, it's actually a clever combination. HTTPS uses TLS transport layer security. And the magic is it uses two types of encryption. First, for the initial handshake, just to securely agree on a secret key for this session, it uses asymmetric encryption. Public key, private key. It's a bit slower, but great for setting things up securely. Then, once they've securely swapped that session key, they switch to symmetric encryption, like AES, maybe for all the actual data going back and forth. Much faster for encrypting lots of data. And the piece that makes you trust the server, that's the certificate. It's like the server's digital ID, signed by a trusted certificate authority, a CA. Your browser has a list of CAs it trusts. If the certificate checks out, signed by a trusted CA, okay, connection proceeds. If not, big warnings.
Okay, so that secure phone line is set up. Handshake done, keys exchanged. What information actually gets sent now to get the Amazon page?
Now comes the HTTP request. Your browser sends a message, typically a JECI request, basically saying, hey, send me the contents of this page. If you were, say, submitting a login form, it would be a PUST request, and your username password would be in the request body and not the URL. And there are also headers sent along with the request, really important metadata, like a content type telling the server what kind of data is coming, or maybe an authorization header with a token if you're already logged in.
Right, headers. The hidden context. And then the server sends stuff back. It can't just be one file.
Exactly. The server response is a whole bundle. You get the basic HTML structure, the CSS files for styling, colors, lay out the JavaScript for interactivity, plus all the images, maybe videos. Your browser then has to do the rendering. It parses the HTML, builds this internal map called the DOM, the document object model, then it applies the CSS, runs the JavaScript, pulls everything together, and paints the page onto your screen.
Wow. That is a lot happening just from typing an address. Amazing. Now, we talked about TCP for that reliable connection, but there's another big protocol, UDP. What's the difference? Why choose one or the other?
Yeah, they're fundamentally different. TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, is like registered mail. It's connection-oriented, sets up a connection first, it's reliable, guarantees data arrives in order, uses acknowledgments, retransmits lost packets, but all that checking adds overhead. It's slower, essential for things like web pages, email, file transfers. You can't miss a single bit. UDP, User Datagram Protocol, is more like shouting across a room. Connectionless, just sends packets out. It's way faster, much lower overhead, but unreliable. No guarantees packets arrive or in what order. No retransmissions. Perfect for, say, video streaming or online gaming or VoIP calls. If you miss a tiny bit of video or audio, you just keep going. Retransmitting old data would be useless, right?
That makes sense. Speed versus certainty. Okay, and thinking about things happening on the fly, what about dynamic ports? And how does that relate, if at all, to dynamic code insecurity?
Good question. Dynamic crops up a bit. So dynamic ports are used on the client side, like your browser. The server listens on a fixed port, like 443. But your machine picks a temporary, high-numbered port from a dynamic range for its end of that specific connection, allows your computer to have many connections open at once. Dynamic code insecurity usually refers to code analyzed while it's running. That's what dynamic application security testing, or DAST, does. It pokes and prods a live application to see if it breaks, finding vulnerabilities in real time. So different contexts, but both about things happening adaptively, you know, during the process.
Got it. Okay, we've traced the requests, seen the protocols. Now let's talk defense. How do we actually protect all this data flying around? What are the core security tools standing guard?
Right, the guardians. There's a whole suite, usually layered. You've got firewalls, the basic traffic cops, filtering based on rules, allow this, block that. IPsec is often used for encrypting traffic between networks, like for VPNs. Then you have IDS, intrusion detection systems, which watch for suspicious patterns and raise alarms. And IPS, intrusion prevention systems, which go a step further and actively try to block the threats they detect. SIEM systems, security information, and event management are crucial. They collect logs from everywhere and correlate events to find complex attacks. Kind of the security nerve center. And DLP, data loss prevention, tries to stop sensitive data from leaking out. Plus NSA, network access control, which controls who and what can even connect to the network in the first place.
That's quite the arsenal. But tools aren't everything. Attackers are clever. What are some common ways they try to get around all this?
Often they go for the human element. Social engineering is huge. Phishing emails, trying to steal credentials, pretexting where they make up a believable story. It works depressingly often. Then there are direct application attacks, exploiting flaws in the software itself, SQL injection to mess with databases, cross-site scripting or XSS to attack other users through the website, buffer overflows, and wireless attacks are still a thing, setting up fake Wi-Fi hotspots, eavesdropping on insecure networks. They often look for the easiest way in.
And we keep hearing about zero trust lately. What does that actually mean? How is it different from just segmenting your network?
It's a fundamental shift in mindset. Traditional security, like segmentation, often trusts things inside the network more than things outside. Zero trust says, trust nothing implicitly. Assume breach. Verify everything, every user, every device, every connection, every single time, regardless of whether it's inside or outside the old perimeter. It's about continuous authentication and authorization based on least privilege. Much harder for attackers to move laterally if they do get in.
Makes sense, but implementing that sounds complex.
It is. Definitely a journey, not a switch you flip.
So with all these threats and defenses, how does an organization actually decide where to spend its limited security budget? You can't do everything.
That's exactly why risk assessment is so critical. It's a formal process. First, identify your key assets, what's truly valuable, your customer data, your intellectual property. Then identify threats to those assets and the vulnerabilities those threats could exploit. Then you assess likelihood. How likely is this attack and impact? How bad would it be if it happened? Multiply those, you get a risk score. That score helps you prioritize. You focus your resources on mitigating the highest risks, the things most likely to cause the most damage. It brings logic to the spending.
Okay, let's dive into cryptography a bit more. It's the bedrock of so much security. Beyond just hiding things, what's its core purpose?
Cryptography is really about establishing trust and certainty in digital interactions. Yes, confidentiality, keeping secrets, is key. But it also provides integrity, ensuring data hasn't been altered. Authentication, proving identity. And non-repudiation, proving someone definitely did something, they can't deny it later. It underpins almost all secure communication online.
We often hear encryption and hashing. They sound similar, maybe, but they're totally different tools, right?
Completely different, and confusing them is dangerous. Encryption is two-way. You encrypt data with a key, you can decrypt it back with the key, or a related key. It's for confidentiality. Think AES for encrypting files. Hashing is a one-way street. You run data through a hash function, you get a fixed-size fingerprint, you cannot get the original data back from the hash. It's for integrity checks and password storage.
Password storage, right? You hash the user's password, store the hash. When they log in, you hash what they type and compare hashes.
Exactly. You never store the actual password. If you encrypted passwords and the key leaked, game over. With hashing, even if the hashes leak, the attacker still has work to do, like brute forcing.
We mentioned asymmetric and symmetric encryption for HTTPS. Can you quickly recap their main uses and maybe the biggest headache in using them?
Sure. Symmetric uses the same key for encrypting and decrypting. Mm-hmm. It's very fast, great for bulk data like the actual web traffic in HTTPS or encrypting your hard drive, AES. The headache, securely sharing that single key in the first place. Asymmetric uses a key pair, a public key, shareable, and a private key, kept secret. Slower, but brilliant for solving the key exchange problem, you can use it to securely swap a symmetric key. Also used for digital signatures to prove origin and integrity. The headache. Managing all those keys and certificates, especially at scale PKI, public key infrastructure is complex.
Key management sounds like the unsung challenge. Okay, let's shift gears. What happens when things go wrong? Alarms are blaring, maybe multiple alarms at once. How do security teams prioritize?
Yeah, alert fatigue is real. Prioritization is crucial. It's not just first come, first served. You weigh factors. How critical is the system affected? Is it the main database or a test server? What's the severity of the alert itself? Is it definite malware or just some suspicious network scan? And what's the potential impact? Could this lead to major data loss or just minor disruption? You combine these often into that risk score impact times likelihood to focus on the biggest fires first.
Okay, let's take a specific scenario. User clicks a dodgy email attachment. What are the steps, and what's a subtle thing an investigator looks for?
Classic case. First, isolate that machine. Cut it off from the network to stop anything spreading. Then, careful collection. Get the email, get the attachment safely. Analyze them, often in a sandbox environment. A subtle thing in the email. Digging deep into the full email headers, not just the from address, to trace its real origin and spot spoofing. On the machine, you hunt for indicators of compromise, weird running processes, unexpected network connections, new files, registry changes if it's Windows, run specialized scans, check logs for lateral movement attempts, then contain, eradicate, recover, and document.
And what if you see strange outbound traffic from a critical server, like it's calling home to somewhere weird?
That's definitely concerning. First, verify the alert. Is it really unusual for this server? If yes, and it looks malicious, isolate it quickly if you can do so safely. Then, analyze that traffic. Where is it going? Destination IP, domain reputation, what protocol, what port, how much data? Sometimes the clue is subtle, maybe using DNS for command and control, hiding data and requests. Simultaneously, you're investigating on the server. What process is making these connections? Is it malware, a compromised legitimate process? Then it's the same cycle, contain, eradicate, recover.
If you suspect malware is on a server, how do you go beyond just antivirus? What's the deeper dive?
AV is just the start. You'd likely use an EDR endpoint detection and response tool for much deeper visibility. Look at running processes, parent-child relationships, network connections per process, loaded modules. Memory analysis is huge. Malware often hides only in RAM. Tools like Volatility let you dissect the memory dump. And detailed log analysis, system logs, application logs, security logs, looking for anomalies, connections being made, files being touched, users being created, correlating everything.
You mentioned analyzing malware itself. What's the difference between static and dynamic analysis?
Two different angles. Static analysis is looking at the malware file itself without running it. You might disassemble it, look at the code, the strings inside it, what functions it imports, gives you clues about its capabilities. Dynamic analysis is running the malware, but in a safe, isolated environment, a sandbox, and watching what does. What files does it create or change? What network connections does it make? What registry keys does it modify? See its behavior in action. You often need both.
And what's process injection? Sounds sneaky.
It is very sneaky. It's a technique where malware injects its malicious code into the memory space of a legitimate running process. So the malicious code runs hidden inside something trusted, like your browser or a system process. It helps evade detection because security software might not flag activity from a known trusted process. DLL injection is a common type.
If an attacker deletes a malicious file, is it truly gone? Can forensics get it back?
Often, yes. Deleting a file usually just removes the pointer to it in the file system table and marks the space as available. The actual data often remains on the disk until it's overwritten. Forensic investigators create a bit-by-bit image of the disk. Then, using tools like Autopsy or FTK Imager, they can scan the unallocated space and often recover deleted files as long as they haven't been overwritten. It's called file carving.
And how does malware try to stay on a system, achieve persistence after a reboot? Where do you look?
Persistence is key for attackers. They want their malware to survive restarts. Common hiding spots on Windows include registry run keys, HKL MHKC run, run once, scheduled tasks, and startup folders. On Linux, common spots are cron jobs, user or system level, system services, or scripts in etcinit.d or profile files. They try to blend in with legitimate startup items.
To catch all this activity, what are the really essential things security teams need to monitor? What events trigger alarms?
You need visibility. Key events include logins, successes, failures, source IPs, privilege escalations, user becoming admin, process creation, what's starting up, network connections, especially outbound to weird places, and significant file modifications, especially system files or sensitive data. Alarms often trigger on thresholds, too many failed logins, specific suspicious patterns, known malware process starting, or deviations from baseline, server connecting to a new country.
What about detecting lateral movement? The attacker moving within the network.
That requires monitoring internal traffic and authentication. Look for unusual RDP or SSH sessions between workstations or servers, abnormal use of administrative shares, SMB traffic, failed logins between internal systems. Prevention relies heavily on network segmentation, breaking the network into smaller zones and strict least privilege. Make it hard for them to jump from one machine to another.
And the nightmare scenario. Data theft, exfiltration, how do you spot that?
Yeah. It's tricky. You look for anomalies in outbound traffic. Large, unexpected data transfers, especially during off hours. Connections to known suspicious IPs or cloud storage services not used by the company. DLP tools are designed for this. They inspect outbound data streams, email, web, etc., looking for patterns matching sensitive information like credit card numbers or internal keywords, and can block or alert on them.
Can you give an example of how combining different logs helps catch something subtle?
Sure. Imagine you see a cluster of failed login attempts from, say, Nigeria. That's one log source. Then, moments later, a successful login for that same account, but this time from the user's usual location, another log source. Then, immediately after that successful login, you see a PowerShell process start on that user's machine, downloading a file from a suspicious URL, endpoint logs, individually, maybe not conclusive, but correlating them in a SIM. That paints a clear picture. Credential stuffing attack, successful compromise, and malware download. That correlation is key.
We keep mentioning SIMs. What are the main parts that make them work?
A SIM has several core functions. Log collection, grabbing logs from everywhere. Normalization, getting all those different log formats into one standard structure. Correlation, the engine that links events together based on rules. Alerting, firing off notifications when rules are triggered. Dashboards, visualizing the data. And reporting for compliance and analysis.
How do teams actually write the rules for those correlation engines? And what logs do they absolutely need?
Rules can range from simple, alert if firewall blocks traffic from known bad IP, to complex, alert if user logs in from new country any, anytime accesses sensitive files and attempts outbound connection within 5 minutes. They're based on known attack patterns, threat intelligence, and baselining normal behavior. Essential log sources, OS logs, Windows event logs, Linux syslog, firewall logs, proxy logs, VPN logs, authentication logs, Active Directory, RADOS, cloud provider logs, AWS, CloudTrail, etc., and critical application logs. More data is generally better, up to a point.
Sounds like it could get noisy. What's detection tuning?
Exactly. Tuning is vital. It's the ongoing process of refining rules to reduce false positives, alerts on benign activity, while ensuring you don't miss real threats. False negatives. You review alerts, investigate, and adjust rule logic, thresholds, or whitelists. It's constant gardening to keep the signal clear from the noise.
How do teams hunt for threats that haven't triggered an alert yet? The unknown unknowns.
That's threat hunting. It's proactive, often hypothesis-driven. An analyst might say, I suspect attackers might be abusing PowerShell remoting in this way, and then actively search logs, network data, and endpoint data for evidence of that specific activity, even without an alert. They often hunt for indicators of compromise, IOCs, specific file hashes, IP addresses, domains, registry keys known to be associated with malware or attackers. Finding an IOC can be the starting point for an investigation.
How does threat intelligence feed into this?
Threat intelligence provides context and known badness. It's curated information about threats, attackers, their methods, TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures, and IOCs. Teams consume threat intel feeds, analyze what's relevant to them, and use it to create new detection rules in their SIM, inform their threat hunting hypotheses, and prioritize patching or defenses.
And one more proactive term. Threat modeling.
Threat modeling happens before things are built, ideally. It's a structured way to think like an attacker about a system or application you're designing. You identify assets, potential threats, vulnerabilities, and potential controls. It helps build security in from the start rather than bolting it on later.
Okay, shifting to applications themselves, web apps, what are the three tiers people talk about securing?
Usually it's the web tier, like Apache or Nginx, handling incoming requests. The application tier, the actual code, maybe Python, Java, PHP, doing logic, and the database tier, SQL Server, Postgres, MongoDB, storing the data. You need security at each layer, input validation, and maybe a WAF at the web tier, secure coding, patching, dependency checks at the app tier, strong access control, encryption at the database tier. A common mistake is focusing only on one, like thinking a WAF solves all app code issues.
JavaScript is everywhere in web apps, but runs in the user's browser. How do you secure that? Seems tricky.
It is tricky. Key things are, use content security policy, CSP headers, to control what scripts can run and where they can connect. Validate and sanitize all input that JavaScript might process or display. Avoid dangerous functions like eval. Keep your third-party libraries obsessively up to date, as they're a huge source of vulnerabilities. It's a moving target because browsers and threats constantly evolve.
What are some classic web vulnerabilities that just won't die and a key mitigation for each?
Oh, the usual suspects. XSS, cross-site scripting. Mitigation isn't just input sanitization, but rigorous output encoding before displaying user content. SQL injection. Use parameterized queries, prepared statements, absolutely, but also enforce least privilege for the database user the application connects as, CSRF cross-site request forgery. Use anti-CSRF tokens for any state-changing request, not just forms. Insecure deserialization. The best mitigation is often to avoid deserializing untrusted data altogether if possible, or at least strictly validate it first.
Moving to the cloud. That shared responsibility model, what's the biggest confusion point?
The biggest confusion is thinking the provider does more than they do. They secure the cloud infrastructure, hardware, facilities, core network. You secure what you put in the cloud, your data, VMs, applications, access controls, configurations. People forget they still need to patch their OS, configure firewalls, manage identities, etc. in the cloud. The provider gives you secure building blocks, but you still have to build securely.
If a cloud account does get compromised, how does the investigation work? Seems harder to track.
It relies heavily on the cloud provider's logs. AWS CloudTrail, Azure Activity Log, GCP audit logs, these record API calls, console logins, resource changes. So you analyze those logs intensely. Who logged in? From where? What did they do? Then rotate credentials immediately. API keys, passwords. Assess the blast radius, what resources were accessed or changed. Remediate, notify. The logs are key, but you need them enabled and need to know how to read them.
Last area. System hardening and forensics basics. Windows versus Linux. What are a couple of go-to artifacts on each?
Sure. On Windows, I immediately look at event logs, security, system application, the registry, especially run keys, services, prefetch files, .pf files showing execution, and maybe grab a memory dump. On Linux, key spots are varlogauth.log, or equivalent for login, varlog syslog, user bash history, the output of PO for running processes, and check cron jobs and system unit files for persistence.
And just general hardening tips. Good for any OS.
Absolutely. Patch religiously. Disable unnecessary service ports. Enforce least privilege. Use strong authentication, MFA, wherever possible. Mm-hmm. Configure firewalls properly, host-based too. And enable good logging. Reduce the attack surface, make compromise harder, and ensure you can detect it if it happens. And just quickly, on forensics, memory analysis tools like Volatility are super important. They let you pull secrets directly out of RAM running processes, network connections, even encryption keys, sometimes things that might never hit the disk.
Is there a core security design difference between, say, Windows and Linux?
I'd say Windows is often more centralized, registry-heavy, with many built-in GUI tools like Defender, BitLocker, UAC, aiming for integrated security. Linux relies more on granular file permissions, is more modular, often command-line focused, with tools like Selinux and Parmer for fine-grained access control and Iptable's NF tables for firewalls. Different philosophies, both can be secure if configured well. macOS has its own unique mix with gatekeepers, SIP, etc.
So final practical tip, deploying a brand new OS instance, what are the absolute first hardening steps?
Before it does anything else, patch it fully. Configure the host firewall, allow only what's needed. Disable and install unneeded service software, set strong password keys, and configure MFA if possible. Enable detailed logging and point it somewhere central if you can. Get that baseline secure before you deploy your application or connect it widely.
Wow. What an incredible journey from just typing www.amazon.com all the way through encryption, firewalls, threat hunting, hardening. It really highlights the sheer complexity hidden beneath our everyday clicks.
It really does. And, you know, understanding these layers, even at a high level, isn't just for the tech pros. Knowing a bit about how it works, the challenges involved, it helps everyone appreciate the technology and maybe think a bit more critically about security. So maybe the thought to leave you with is this: knowing a bit more about this hidden machinery, how does that change how you think about your own online safety? Does it make you look at that little lock icon differently or think twice about the Wi-Fi you connect to? What vulnerabilities seem more real to you now in your day-to-day digital life?